Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Richard Stratton, and he is out with the third in his series of memoirs about his, well, basically being a victim of the government's war on plants. This book is called In the World, From the Big House to Hollywood. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Arcade Press. Richard has previously written Smuggler's Blues and Kingpin, which detailed not only the investigation by the DEA and FBI against him for pot smuggling and Kingpin, he also detailed his time in prison, and this deals with his time as he got out of prison, got back on his feet, and became a successful writer and a Hollywood writer. So, Richard, as I welcome you in here, can you kind of just set up what was it with the war on plants that ended up bringing you down in the first place?
Well, you know, it was a different time, obviously. In those days, marijuana was considered the plant that had roots in hell. It was believed by many people that once you started using marijuana, it was the beginning of drug addiction and you'd end up becoming a heroin addict. When I came of age, which was in the 60s and early 70s, that began to change. Young Americans were experimenting with marijuana. It was the time of Woodstock and the whole sort of social hippie movement. And political changes were taking place, a lot of which was involved with this whole cannabis plant. People who smoked marijuana tended to disbelieve a lot of the propaganda that was out there, not only about the plant itself, but about the war in Vietnam and about race relations and a whole variety of things. So there was a big cultural change taking place at the same time that this plant made its very popular appearance in American culture. So I became part of that. I was went to school in Arizona at the Arizona State University, and started making trips into Mexico more or less as a tourist and just on vacations. And quite by chance, I ended up buying a couple of kilos of marijuana and hiding it in the door panel of the truck that we were driving at that time and smuggling it back into the United States, bringing it back to New England, to Massachusetts, and selling it to my friends. And I made $1,500, which at that point, I was 19 years old. It was the early 60s. It was a lot of money. And that changed my life. I'd gone to school on a wrestling scholarship and ended up becoming a marijuana smuggler. I then started traveling around the world, importing marijuana and hashish from different parts of the country, from different parts of the world, and became a professional pot smuggler. Then, you know, at that time, the war on drugs, and particularly the war on marijuana, was heating up to the point where they changed the sentences. In the early days, it was a maximum of 5 years. Then they changed it to up to 15 years for marijuana. And then finally, they instituted these whole new sets of laws where if you were convicted under the so-called Kingpin statute, you could be sentenced to life with no possibility of parole for smuggling pot. I got arrested in 1982, ended up going to trial in 1984, and was charged under that so-called Kingpin statute, facing a mandatory sentence of possible life without parole in prison. Fortunately for me, at that point in time, it was still a 10-year minimum up to life. 6 months later, if I had been sentenced 6 months later, I would have had a mandatory life sentence and I'd still be locked up. Once I got to prison, I had a 15-year non-parolable sentence, but I became a jailhouse lawyer and I found an illegality in my sentence where the judge who sentenced me in New York said that the reason she was giving me so much time was because I refused to cooperate with the government. And by that, what they meant was I refused to become an informant and name other people. I basically said, look, this is me, I did it. I'm not going to give you the names and tell you, sit there and testify against other people. I'm taking the responsibility for my own actions. And for that, the judge said, well, if you change your mind and decide to cooperate with the government, I'll reduce your sentence based on your cooperation. I never did cooperate with the government, but I appealed my sentence on the grounds that it was a coercive sentence rather than a punitive sentence, which turns out to be illegal. While I was locked up, I became a jailhouse lawyer and started studying the law, and I found that there were court cases where it said that it's permissible to give someone less time for cooperating, but it's not permissible to give you more time for refusing to cooperate, because then the sentence becomes coercive rather than punitive. So I appealed my sentence on those grounds, and the sentence in New York was vacated, and I was brought back and resentenced to 10 years. Now, I served 8, and after 8 years, with good time, I got out. In 1990, I was released from prison. While I was in prison, I had written a novel called Smack Goddess that was published shortly after I got out of prison, and I went to work for a criminal defense lawyer in New York City, which is basically what this third volume of the trilogy is about. It starts on the day that I was released from prison and takes me up through my becoming involved in the film and television worlds, the writing books and writing screenplays. And I actually, even though I had a non-parolable sentence, I was told as I left the prison that I had 48 hours to report to my parole officer. And I said, well, wait a minute, now this is a non-parolable sentence. And they said, yeah, well, you're not going to be on parole. You're going to be on what's known as supervised release, which is just another way of saying parole. So I reported to my parole officer in New York, and while I was there, I developed this idea for a TV show idea about people coming out of prison on parole, trying to readjust to civilization as we know it on the outside of prison after a long time of being locked up, which is something that still fascinates me, this whole idea of how one readjusts to living in free society after having been locked up. So In the World, which is the new book, starts out on the day that I left prison in 1990 and tells the story of how I got into the film and TV industry. What happened there was that a friend of mine knew a documentary filmmaker, a famous documentary filmmaker named Barbara Koppel, who was doing a documentary about Mike Tyson, who had just been in trouble himself for sexual assault, rape. And they hired me to write the proposal for the documentary series, the documentary rather. And after I wrote that, I was hired as a line producer. And I started running around setting up interviews with people and setting up film crews, and it fascinated me. It really, the business of filmmaking, I thought to myself, this is something that's even more engaging and more rewarding than smuggling pot. So I felt like I had found a new profession. After that, I worked on a documentary called When We Were Kings about Muhammad Ali's championship bout in Zaire, Africa, which won an Academy Award. And then I did a series of documentaries for HBO all about prison life. Prisoners of the War on Drugs was one of them. Execution Machine, Texas Death Row was another one. Then there was a third one called Gladiator Days, Anatomy of a Prison Murder. And finally, we did another one called Thug Life in D.C. that won an Emmy Award. So that began my career in the film industry. We then made a feature film called Slam that we shot in Washington, D.C., and that film won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. It won the Camera d'Or at Cannes and really started my whole career in the filmmaking and film writing business.
And as we read this book, it's almost as if we're reading in the present tense, watching you do these things. And you mentioned in there that you had journals from this era. You were a writer, you know, you were a writer when you went into prison. And so coming out, did you have this idea of a memoir in mind, or were you journaling for your own purposes? What was the purpose of that?
You know, I started writing a journal when I was in my teens. And it just, I don't know, it was kind of, I guess because of the times that I was living in, you know, the 60s and the 70s, it seemed like there was so much social change going on that I wanted to make a record of it, and it may be some kind of personal obsession of mine, but I always felt that once I got it into language, once I put it down on paper, it made more sense to me. It's become kind of my own self-therapy, kind of, so to speak. Of writing is just something that I started doing at an early age. I remember one of my teachers at boarding school at that time, had said to me after I submitted an essay, said, "You know, you've got a talent for this. You should stick with it." And that struck me. And then I became. I started writing journalism. I got a fellowship to the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is where I met Norman Mailer, who became very close. He and I became really close. He was my mentor, so to speak. So writing was something that even before I went to prison, I was writing. I was a journalist, and I wrote this book while I was in prison. So the whole smuggling marijuana, and that was, I used to say that I smuggled pot to support my writing habit, and that was really more like it. It was just tough to make a living as a journalist in those days, and you know, I would smuggle pot, and then I would write and smuggle pot, and the two kind of balanced each other out in a way.
Well, and you also detail in here some of the things from prison, kind of brings us up to date if anybody hasn't picked up the first two memoirs, but you went on to write for Oz, which is a show that I remember watching on HBO back in the day when it was in the first run. So you've really put this together, and I learned a lot from it because I think people are enthralled with the prison life because most people don't live that.
Well, and you know, the other thing that's interesting to me, and I do write about it in the book. Of course, this book, the third volume, is really about getting out, and as I put it, getting out and getting free. It's one thing to get out of prison. It's another thing to get free of the culture that becomes so much a part of who you are if you spend a long time in a maximum security prison environment. I spent 8 years in prison, and I've always felt that anything over 4 or 5 years, it changes you. It changes you fundamentally because you're living in a culture that's so different from the outside world, and yet in some ways, it's like a microcosm of what goes on out there. And when you come out, it's very difficult to readjust to living in a free society. You know, one of the things that's most interesting is that, for me anyway, how much more rude people are out here on the street than they are in prison. I mean, if you step in front of somebody in line in prison, it could be a major problem. Out here, people push you and shove you, and you know, I remember shortly after I got out, in fact, I was living in Brooklyn Heights in Mailer's place, and the family was away, and I was taking care of their dog, and this little dog, a pug dog that Mailer had at that time, who lifted his leg and peed on the steps or the balustrade of the steps in front of the Mailer home. And one of the guys who lived in the downstairs apartment came out and immediately got right in my face. "What are you doing putting your dog around here, letting your dog," not realizing maybe that it was Mailer's dog and the dog lived in that building and had a right to pee there. So I just lost it. I mean, I was right back in the prison mentality. I threw the guy up against the wall and I was ready to attack him because he was physically attacking me, pushing me and being aggressive with me. So these things, these habits, this culturization that you go through if you spend a long time in maximum security prisons where your personal space is so important that it takes a long time. And a lot of people don't make it. You know, they come out and they can't readjust. So many of my friends that I became close to in prison couldn't make it out here. They got back into whatever they were doing before. They got new charges, new cases, and couldn't make it. And so it's a big problem, you know, especially when you think there's something like 60,000 people a year being released from prisons all over this country. And there's very little kind of counseling that goes on in there. There's very little where they try to help you readjust once you get out. So it became a subject that fascinated me, the whole idea of not only getting out of prison, but getting free of the prison culture that becomes so much a part of who you are when you're locked up.
Well, the book was absolutely amazing. I learned so much from it. It entertained me from front to back cover. The book is In the World, From the Big House to Hollywood. It's the newest memoir from Richard Stratton. He's also got Smuggler's Blues and Kingpin available to read this story. You need to read this story because it is so innovative to read these words by somebody who's actually lived the life. Richard Stratton, thanks for joining us to share these words with us.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.